over the last few weeks, we've been hearing some really damning stories about the personal independence payment assessment. Remember we heard from Aisling, her 16-year-old son Pierce is severely disabled, requiring 24-hour care. He has cerebral palsy, a learning disability, he takes seizures, he can't walk, he's non-verbal, and he's peg-fed through a tube. When he was assessed, he got 1 out of 8 for administering his own medication and 2 out of 10 for eating and drinking. Then there was John McMullen. His son, Declan, has locked-in syndrome. He can only blink. He was scored 2 out of 8 for managing his own treatments, 6 out of 8 for eating and drinking. Lewis Nicol, Tourette syndrome, swears uncontrollably, physical tics, got 0 for mixing with other people, swearing at the assessor when she was assessing him, and he got 0 for communicating during his PIP assessment. Remember, the higher the score, the more need. And he got 0 for communicating, despite the fact that he swears uncontrollably. Now, after our continuing coverage, an interview was arranged with Dr. Ian Gargan, the Chief Medical Officer of CAPITA, and Dr. Cher Faisal, the Medical Director for Great Britain CAPITA, who both flew in from England for us. I spoke with them, along with Colin Boyle, the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Communities. We can now let you hear that interview. I started by talking to Colm. He was concerned about the public impression as to how robust the CAPITA assessments are.
I think it's a need for us, Stephen, to ensure that people out there actually understand how well PIP is rolling out. And I just wanted to put that in, some of that in context for people. Since June 2016, we've made 150, almost 150,000 PIP decisions. 7,000 a month, a big number. Now, in terms of a big number, we've had 9% of appeals and 2% of those overturned. That's about half of the appeals get overturned. Now, that mainly
2% about, of the 150,000?
Yes.
Or 2% of the...
2% of the 150,000, yeah. So appeals tend to get overturned, normally arising from oral evidence from the person at a hearing or new written evidence not seen by the department. And That can happen, okay. Now, when you actually look at what we've done with...
Before we go on, because I don't want us to get lost in percentages,
yeah.
But you're conveying this to the public this morning as 2% of the 150,000. Mm-hmm. But of those people who decide to appeal, of the 9% who decide to appeal, it's nearly 50% are overturned.
That's correct.
So 1 in 2 of all appeals are successful.
And in a situation where we have a new benefit, Stephen, and a benefit that's evolving and starting to mature, that's not unusual, and we're not concerned about that.
So is it not right yet? When you use the word evolving?
Well, evolving means there's room for improvement and scope for improvement.
So why aren't you concerned then?
Well, I'm not concerned because of some other examples which I'm about to give you. Things like 76% of claimants awarded PIP following the DLA reassessment. That's fantastic news for people. More people are being awarded PIP at the highest rate of benefit than under DLA. 38% of PIP recipients are getting the highest level of benefit compared to 15% of working age when they were in DLA. It's outstripping DLA, and it's outstripping DLA in a number of different respects. That is not getting out there. And I want people to have the trust in the process. We don't get everything perfect every time. But I want people to have the trust in the process to know that we have gone through a process where we've looked at 150,000 cases, and to get a 9% appeal rate, okay, even with the 50% overturn on that for me is a phenomenal outturn, and a phenomenal outturn by our staff as well. We've done a terrific job on it.
Well, it might be for you a phenomenal outcome, because you're reading into that only 9% of people are appealing. Only 9% of people might be appealing because they don't trust you that their appeal will be worth anything. So you can't read into the 9% that's somehow a significant figure. You know, we simply don't know.
Yeah, but
if these are people with complex needs.
They are, and look, I've listened to a lot of things that have been said and spoken about. I have every sympathy with some of the situations that people are in. I have family members who are applying for PIP. I've had family members who have applied for DLA. I know firsthand how difficult this is and how traumatic this can be for people and how they feel they're being judged by this assessment process. It is a complex process. It's a difficult process. But it's also difficult for us to actually make it happen as well. So that's what I'm trying to say. We're doing a good job with this. Not perfect, but coming on very, very well.
OK, so Dr. Ian Gargan, you're the Chief Medical Officer for the PIP process within Capita. As we stand at the moment, 50% of the assessments that your company is doing, the results are overturned, the determinations are overturned. 50% of the time.
50% of the people that go to appeal.
Correct.
And you go to appeal after you go through a number of escalation processes. So if you're not happy with your assessment, and I really think it's important for claimants out there to hear this, we want to hear that you're not happy about it. There's a reconsideration application. You can have your case reviewed. You can talk to our escalation teams. There are lots and lots of ways in which you can address your dissatisfaction.
And after they go through all that, exactly.
Tribunal. Yes.
But it makes my point even more for me. That once they've gone through all of that, are you not concerned that 50% of those appeals are wrong?
Stephen, it's my job to be concerned every day about every single claimant. So I'm not denying that I'm not concerned. I'm saying that, yes, I'm continuing to learn. We want to make it
better. Is 50% a good figure in your view?
I don't think that anyone should get the wrong decision.
Come on. Of course you don't. But that's not an answer to my question, sir.
That's what I'm trying
to
tell you.
Is 50% a reasonable result rate for Capita? You will have a reasonable result rate where you think to yourself, well, that's us doing a good job. So I'm not asking you, well, should you get it right every time? Is 50%, do you think that suggests that's a professional organisation working as it should?
So logically, from what I said, that everyone should get the right decision would mean that 50% isn't good enough. However, in terms of results, first of all, there isn't a target result that we're meant to get. We have an independent assessment carried out by a person, as a professional clinician, who doesn't assign a score, just gives the right justification to a descriptor. And then we're held to account on certain quality standards. And those quality standards, some of which have been met, some of which we're definitely meeting all the time, and some of which we've still to improve upon. And I guess built into that, and we have numbers about reworks and advices, etc. So you can blitz it with like lots of different approaches. Obviously, I'd prefer if no one had to go to appeal, if they're absolutely satisfied with the outcome of their assessment report. And then, but the appeals process is there for that exact reason.
Yeah, but Ian, if I just listen to some of the words, you're the chief medical officer. Mm-hmm. So you're a very senior person within Capita. In fact, you have overall responsibility for PIP. And you have no idea in this interview what a target should be that you would think in your head, well, 50% is a bit high. It should be 30. It should be 20. You have no idea.
No, I've just,
and you keep on defaulting back to, well, one's too many. You're the man at the top.
Sure.
Is 50%, if it was always 50%, as this process is evolving, are you happy?
No.
So what's your target?
I don't want anyone to have to go to appeal.
So your target's 100%.
But do you want me? It's not useful for me to pick an arbitrary 10%. I've talked to Mr.
Duffy. Does 50% give you concern?
Every day I'm concerned about how to do this better. Of course it gives me concern. And every day I want to know how to do it better and how our assessors are taught better, learn better, and we have more accurate reports. And when it's concerning for any claimant that's unhappy about it, Stephen. This is not, I think some people might have a perception that because you're chief medical officer, you sit on high and look at this and go, oh, this is maybe good and maybe not. You know, I'm still a doctor. All of the disability assessors are still nurses, physios, OTs and medics. We care about these claimants. I care about what's going on for them. And quality is absolutely for. I'm not going to absolutely dress that up in any other way. Let's be absolutely clear. I would prefer if someone got their assessment report and said, that's exactly the way I perceive that it would go. So there's some part of it with the claimants maybe need to be educated what their expectation is from the assessment report or maybe what information they should send us so that we have more insight to be able to write a better assessment report so they don't have to appeal. But first and foremost, our disability assessors and I, and Sha beside me here, and I know Colin does as well, we're aligned to a duty of care so no claimant should feel stressed and should feel that they had a fair and equal assessment.
Well, and that's the focus of our programme. There clearly are claimants feeling stressed. There are clearly claimants who don't understand some of the system, and there are claimants who are bemused by some of their scores, and I want to get into that. Before I do so, just so the public know, I've participated in a briefing with all three of you before the interview today, and what I learned from that briefing is that, look, when you're coming up with the conclusion that you're going to pass to the department so that they will assign a score, there are three elements. There's a claim form that the applicant fills in with information. There is your assessor's report, and then there are doctor's reports. Is that right? Can you talk me through that?
Yes. So there's the claim form, And then there is the that the individual, the claimant, writes out, or an appointee that they've asked to do it for them. Then they we decide when they when we look at the claim form, which has gone through a couple of steps with the Department for Communities first. We get the claim form and we decide from the evidence that we have available and the claim form, would it be better to do this assessment by paper-based review? Still a disability assessor. So we've sufficient evidence. We think we can give the right descriptors, which we do in about 9% of the cases. Or the rest of the cases, 90% of the cases, we say, no, we'd actually get more. We need to look for more evidence. So we write to the GPs, but we run other people, which I'll go to in a second. And we need to see the claimant face to face. So that's in our clinic or in their home. And that's about a 50-50 split. So then we carry out the assessment. And we have a duty of care to look for all the evidence. There's two independent reviews that have been done by Northern Ireland and England and Wales since the inception of this benefit by Mr. Paul Gray and Mr. Walter Radar. And they both say, let's get away from moving this. Let's move away from this being a medical assessment. It's a functional assessment relevant to people's medical condition. But the evidence that you go looking for shouldn't be just from GPs. It should be from the claimant's families. It should be from a community psychiatric nurse, physios, OTs, etc. So we get that evidence. We then do a face-to-face assessment. And then the disability assessor assigns certain descriptors and justifications to each activity. And then that those activity, of which there's 12... And then within those 12 activities, there's a number of subsections, which can be 5 or 6 for each activity. Then each of those scores reflects a point, or each of those descriptors reflects a certain amount of points, which we don't
assign.
What's
a descriptor?
So, shall I want to come in?
So each, as Ian said, there are 12 activities within the PIP assessment, and each activity then has descriptor. So the descriptor defines what difficulties a claimant might have in completing that daily activity.
And there are just 12 descriptors.
There are 12 activities, and each activity has 5 to 6 descriptors at least.
Why don't you lot just assign the score?
Because that is
why are you passing
job.
The score over to the department?
We carry out an independent assessment where we have to be completely objective in what we assign a descriptor or to each activity, and then the person, people who make the decision and hold the purse strings for the benefit. They assign the score and decide.
But in assigning the descriptor, you're highly influencing the score.
But that's the policy as it is, Stephen. So that's been set by legislation and the Parliament. Like we've been asked to do a job, we carry out the assessment. Who decides who apportions the score and the benefit is way beyond my remit. It's much more a legislative issue.
What I think we need to do here, or this interview is just going to, and it will be my fault, bamboozle everybody even more, is we need to talk about, you know, real issues, give real examples, or at least hypothetical examples, okay? So someone comes in and they have Tourette's, all right? So they're swearing all over the place and they can't control it. What do you do?
So I think shall focus on some of the activities that may be pertinent to someone who's suffering with Tourette's.
Yeah, so when someone comes with Tourette's, what our healthcare professionals will do, they will ask them questions about, you know, the history.
No, they will first of all fill in a form, won't they? Yeah. So they will fill in the form.
Yeah, I was talking about when they come to us. So when they fill in a form, that will come to DFC, that will then send it to Capita Space. So we will look into the form. And based on the information within the form, we will then, the disability assessor will then make a view whether we need to go for further evidence in order to be able to complete the report, if we can, as a paper base, or do we need to see this person face-to-face? So, for example, if the decision is made that based on the information that is available to us that we need to do a face-to-face assessment, that claimant will be either called into a clinic, or if the information provided is such that we need to make a home visit, we will do a home visit and see that claimant. But the end result will be that we undertake a face-to-face assessment. And what happens in that face-to-face assessment is that we will then gather information from the claimant and whoever is accompanying them with the consent of the claimant to give us more information. And the DA will then ascertain the severity of their condition, how their condition is affecting them in their day-to-day life.
And that sounds like a robust process, doesn't it? sounds really robust. So the paperwork goes in, that's assessed by Capita, and Capita have all of these very powerful people at the top, a chief medical officer and yourself, you are, Shah, you're the medical director. So there are lots of robust checks here, and the department then, Colm's department, is checking it again. Have a listen to this example. This is someone with Tourette's, one of my listeners. This is one of your clients.
You can express and understand verbal information unaided. And the scores out of 12, I got 0, mate. It's not normal. Oh, this is why whenever I'm being assessed, I'm feeling nervous, I'm feeling awkward. Like, that's not a nice position for anybody, especially if you have Tourette's, because whenever you feel nervous and awkward, you tick more. So, I'm literally sitting ticking and ticking and ticking, literally, like, sweating, and, like, I feel nervous, I feel awkward. I just want to get out of the room at that point. Literally, I had my brother with me. My brother had to help me with some of the things I was trying to say because it was worse then. You know what I mean? Like, this is all right. I'm in my house. I'm relaxed. I'm sitting beside my dog talking on the phone. Like, my tics are okay now. At the time, whenever, like, obviously I was nervous. They were a lot worse whenever I was being assessed. 0 out of 12. I couldn't believe it. And then I got 0 out of 12 for mixing with other people.
You're the chief medical officer. Does that embarrass you?
I feel it's very sad. I don't...
No, your result. Not him. Nothing sad about him. Does your result and your assessment scoring that young man as 0?
So can we talk about what the complexities of the descriptors are and how they may apply or may not?
We can in a moment. Does that embarrass you?
I feel that every case needs to be looked at.
Come on, you're not a politician. Does that embarrass you? He's a citizen of this country and he's one of your clients and you're paid to be fair to him. You've scored him 0 out of 12 for communication.
The specific case, I can't comment on.
Yes, you can.
Stephen, I empathise with the young man and feel like
Does it embarrass you?
I do say, and he did say that he's very stressed going through the assessment process.
No,
I don't feel that's appropriate.
I'm talking about your score.
I don't even know what the score is. I heard some of what the assessment is. I haven't looked at the case, and we're very happy to review every case. You know that we can look at every case like this. And I had said at the outset of the conversation that sometimes there have been mistakes, and I apologise if there's been a mistake made for this young man.
You said in our briefing that you're not allowed to talk about individual cases. The GMC doesn't allow you.
So specific cases about the details of their medical conditions, no. But we can talk about, like, I've listened to that case. That's how I interpret the General Medical Council, and I've been practicing medicine for 20 years. So.
And you're the Chief Medical Officer of Capita. So what it actually says on the GMC website, 25th of April 2017, however tempting it may be to respond if you're criticised publicly, particularly if the report is inaccurate or unfair, you must not put confidential information in the public domain without your patient's explicit consent. It then talks about explicit consent right throughout the GMC codes of practice in talking about patients.
Well, I haven't asked for his consent. I don't have consent to discuss his case.
Why not?
Because I don't have consent. I haven't talked to the young man.
Have a listen to this next clip. Lewis, in case the Department of Communities, which I would bet my house they'll do, comes back and says we cannot comment on individual cases, are you giving us permission, explicit permission, for them to comment on your case?
Mate, they can comment on my case because, quite frankly, I want to know what's going on with my case. You know what I mean? I'm confused with it, mate. Like, the things that my, like, I got points for weird things, like preparing food. I need a bit of help preparing food. But it's not as bad as going and communicating with someone. It's just weird, mate. I don't know what way to try to assess this. Whenever I was there, I'm talking to the girl. I feel like she had a few things on her mind that she wanted to assess me on. She asked me the exact same things as the paper. Can I run? She asked me, can I walk 200 metres unaided? I was like, you really don't know my brain disorder. I could tick and fall and not be able to walk again, or I could tick and fall and have to get a lift home, or like, there's so many things wrong. I feel like the people that are assessing, they don't know any, like, I feel like they know basics, but they don't know anything for personal people. Like, my brain disorder, there was no one there that knew much about it whenever I was getting assessed. There was no one there that knew anything about it apart from me and my brother. And it was just, f***ing him, f***ing. And, like, that's the impression I felt whenever I was there. I felt, f***ing him, f***ing. Like, I was one weird person in a sea of, like, people that were just there to get their job done and leave.
The bravery, and I am going to move on, but the bravery of a young man, and I know that young man, and he's been suicidal because of his disability, and he sums up the bravery to appeal through the media and to give explicit consent that we can all learn from his case. And Capita hides behind some issue that doesn't exist, that it's impossible for you to talk about his individual case. It is not.
Well, I'm learning about his case today and talking about it with you, so I'm not hiding behind information. I know from 20 years of working in surgery and as a psychologist before surgery that whenever I wanted consent to talk about a patient's information with another clinician or even with their family member, they had to write and give me Ian Gargan consent. So that gentleman hasn't said Ian Gargan has consent.
Yeah, but
to
you
talk
could have gone and get
it.
And the Department of Communities, you call them, your position is that no matter whether the public give permission as a way of them trying to appeal for answers, as a way of them trying to help society, you'll not talk about individual medical cases either, will you?
We will address any case that anyone brings to us, and we'll pick those cases up. We've already picked this case up.
But you won't talk publicly about someone?
No, we will never do that, Stephen.
Even if they appeal to you to do it?
No, Stephen, we won't.
Why not?
Well, we have a duty of care to every person that we deal with.
But if they give you permission, why not?
Well, they might give permission today, but they might feel differently about it in a month's time, or 3 months' time, or 6 months' time. They might feel exploited, Stephen.
Sure, so you know better than them.
No, I'm not saying we know better than them, but I just think in terms of safeguarding any issues that might crop up later on.
And it's nothing to do with being handy that it stops all of you being accountable for specific incidents?
Any incident that's brought to our attention, and anything, by the way, any case that comes on your airwaves, we'll pick them up. If there's been any mistakes that we've made, we'll pick them up.
Okay.
If we have to apologise for anything, we'll apologise and we'll deal with it.
So let's broaden this beyond Lewis. We know about cases where people with Tourette's have been given zero for communication. Dr. Shah Faisal, can you explain to me how anybody who swears uncontrollably, who has said, I have seen documentation where Capita has recorded someone with Tourette's is saying, I do not feel comfortable because I can't control my swearing. So Capita have registered it and then simply said he gets a zero for that. How could that happen to any citizen?
Now, there are two areas that you're talking about. One is communicating verbally, which assesses a claimant's physical ability to be able to speak a simple or a complex sentence, which in this case I can hear, he can speak. The other area that he is likely to be considered is when he is engaging with other people face to face in a social context.
It's also about verbal communication.
Yeah.
So if he's swearing, do you think that might impede someone's ability to communicate?
I can only go by what is in the legislation and what is in the PIPAC. Now, the PIPAC clearly says if somebody can speak a simple or a complex sentence, physically, they may not score in that area, but that doesn't mean that they will not score because of his disability or because of his impairment that he's not going to score in other areas of the PIP. He is very likely to score in the area of engagement with other people face-to-face. And this is the area where he is likely to score. And I hearing to what he's saying and the how...
He scored him zero.
The way he's affecting, he should have scored in the activity 9.
He scored him zero.
Yes. Mistakes can happen. DA might have underassessed his need in that particular area, which there are ways of having to correct that mistake. You know, we can have reconsideration request from the department, and we can look into it. There is a team in our company that is called Escalations, who can then look into it, and these are the independent individuals who can then give advice back to the DFC.
Well, you've asked us to really, really probe into what Capita and the Department for Communities is actually doing with regards to PIP. That's what we're doing, an extensive interview with them. We can hear more after the news, and we're taking your calls. Right, let's come back to your interview on PIP. This is with Dr. Ian Gargan, the Chief Medical Officer at Capita, Dr. Shal Faisal, the Medical Director for Great Britain Capita. They both flew in from England to speak to us, and Colin Boyle, the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Communities. Before the news, we were talking about Lewis Nicol to Colin Boyle. Lewis is the young man who has Tourette's, and he came on to this programme after his PIP assessment.
It's such a stark case. It's actually quite effective in communicating a message and helping us to understand. So I'm not trying to look at something that just exposes a mistake, because I make plenty of them, right? It's about the system. So the system in a case like this is that Capita will make an assessment. So first of all, it was written down in his application form that he had Tourette's. So that's the first piece of information there. Then there was a follow-up, and he kept on repeatedly swearing in front of your assessor. So that wasn't engaged as even scoring 1 point out of 12 for any difficulty mixing with other people. Then there's a double lock. It goes from Capita to your department, Colin Boyle. So let's differentiate this from Lewis, because despite him giving his explicit permission to talk about him, you're refusing to do so. So we then know that there's a double lock. So Capita cock up and it goes to the Department of Communities. Mm-hmm. And you don't spot it either.
On occasions that can happen, yeah.
Why?
Listen, we're looking at very huge volumes of cases being processed through. On average, we're pushing through 7,000 cases a month. And I say pushing through. We're talking about trying to get a balance between doing this on a timely basis for people so they're not waiting forever for an outcome, which is one of the criticisms we get. This is already, people are already scared about this or nervous about this. Some people say they're traumatised by it. So having to wait this period of time. So you try to do it at a particular pace. You also try to make sure you manage the quality of it right. Sometimes things get missed, Stephen. And there is no arrogance in our system. There is no complacency in our system. And if we have genuinely made any mistake on any case, we will look at that again. And we will revisit it and we will correct it.
Sure. Okay. And I can talk, and then I want to move on to the more systemic stuff. I can talk about other individual cases. I'm not going to play them. Like Declan, who can only blink. He has locked-in syndrome. He was given 2 out of 8 for managing his treatment, 2 out of 8 for needing assistance with budgets. Pierce, who's 16. His mother says he's the mental health of a 4-year-old baby. Peg fed since 12. 2 out of 8 for feeding. Now, my point to you, Colm, is when the BBC brought you the information about those people, the statement that came back from your organisation was, well, if they want to complain, tell them to contact us. So you didn't reach out to them. You didn't say, my goodness, we might have got this wrong. You put the onus on them to contact you.
Well, I think our reaction was, we have a process there, and a well-grooved process there, which people know to use. So that was informing our reaction, to be totally honest.
Okay. On the feeding, and you're here now, to be fair to you, on the issue of someone who is peg fed, let's distance it from this young man. Shall I help me understand, because how someone could get such a low score, a 1 or a 2, when there's a heading called feeding and they're peg fed into their body?
Yeah. So as we discussed earlier, if somebody is peg fed and they can manage it themselves, there is a low scoring descriptor. If they need help of another person or assistance of another person to manage that peg feed for them, they are likely to score the second highest descriptor in the PIPAC.
But 2 would be the lowest, wouldn't it?
Two would be.
So what does 2 say? Because I think from my understanding is the difficulty that all of you genuinely have is that ordinary members of the public, it's like getting 2 out of 10 in your exams. It's not great. So if you get 2 out of 10 in your peg fed, as an ordinary member of the public, you think that's got to be a mistake. So what does 2 say?
So 2 is not, the descriptor that scores 2 points is not what you would consider for somebody who is peg fed. It's for somebody who actually needs assistance to cut up their food, you know, or they need to use an aid, for example, because they have a physical restriction that they can't cut up their food. So they will score a 2. Which is 2B descriptor. But if somebody is peg fed, as I said, if they can manage it themselves, they will score 2C, which is the next higher descriptor. Or if they need assistance of another person to do it for them, they will score 2E, which is the second last.
But it's still a 2.
Yeah.
And that's your difficulty, genuine difficulty, isn't it? That the public are, and people like me are seeing twos and going, what are you doing? So in a scoring system of eight, and if we take that feeding example, Shah, and someone gets a two, explain to the public what they would need, what their condition would need to be for them to get an eight or a seven or eight. I think that would be helpful.
Right, OK. So for somebody to score the highest in terms of the feeding, they are unlikely to be able to convey food to their mouth. So physically, they're either having paralysis of both their arms, their hands, or they probably had an injury in which both their hands were amputated. So now they are reliant on another person to put food and drink into their mouth. But they should still be able to chew and swallow. So if they can eat and drink, but just need the help of another person to put food into their mouth, they will be scoring the highest descriptor. If they have a peck feed, even if they can't eat, but if they have a peck feed and that need the assistance of another person, then they're going to score the next higher descriptor.
But if you are peg fed, so how do you get a two if you're peg fed?
No, you don't get a two. You get a higher descriptor than a two.
No, you give them a two.
We're talking about activity two, and then with which there's a total. Just to be clear as well, the disability says it doesn't assign a score, but we know what the points are. Yep. We're making that here.
Sure.
So that we're saying that the example, and we're not talking specific cases, but in generic for peg feed is a 2E, which is 8 points. So that's so on activity two, a case of peg should receive 8 points.
Okay. On a score of two, and I know you don't do the scores, but you must have an understanding of them. Could you explain to the public how someone who is peg-fed could get a score of two?
As I said to you, they will not be scoring two. You know, they will be scoring a higher descriptor.
No, not descriptor. In terms of then the department giving them a score of two, which is at the bottom of the scale.
So if they're peg-fed, they shouldn't get a two. They should get an eight. And a peg-fed in this particular case was an administrative error. But in other parts of that assessment, all of the other scores or the descriptors were correct. And when we were asked to look at that, we knew that there was administrative error on that activity too. So I think that's it. But the example of the peg is an 8, a 2E.
Sure. But I want to go back and then we'll move on to the next section. But to go back again to the confidence that the public should have in the system, again, how does the double lock, if you like, not spot an administrative error?
So
it's ticked in the wrong place.
Yeah.
But then there's a verbal descriptor. So Capita doesn't pick up on that. And then lo and behold, there's the department. Hmm. That double lock doesn't pick up on it. And the only reason it's revealed is because that person has the bravery to come to the BBC.
And absolutely, or I'd applaud their bravery. And I'd ask them, people, if they feel that the assessment isn't correct and they looked at it, to go through the process of complaint like we named. There is an internal quality assurance process, which is quality learning and support, whereby we double check our reports. But I think also very independently, or very importantly, there's an independent audit function whereby the Department for Communities can take a sample of the work and does take a sample of our work to quality control it. And that happens every month. Actually, it takes a sample every week.
Can we talk, please, about the training that the assessors are given? Because, again, this is coming through from our audience. Here's what we're hearing. We're hearing that these people are medical professionals and that they are trained, and you can tell us about that. But people are concerned who have specific illnesses that, look, they knew nothing about my specific illness. Lewis there actually said it out loud when he was saying they knew nothing about my Tourette's. So let's distance it from him to help you. In what way are these people trained?
Yeah.
And are you then putting specifically trained people to match the illnesses?
So we have a disability assessor by legislation has to be a minimum of 2 years registered in their profession. So after university. So, and they can be an occupational therapist, physiotherapist, paramedic, nurse or a doctor. OK, if they apply to us and we think they're a good applicant, they undergo a disability assessor foundation program, 5 weeks of classroom teaching. And then they go into the field under the supervision of coaches and they have to reach a certain quality standard before they're allowed to work alone effectively. And that usually takes about 3 months and it takes a lot of work. And, you know, every single assessment takes in total, in terms of looking at all the information and writing it up, anywhere between 3 and 4 hours. All right. And on average, our reports are about 3,000 words. This is actually quite a comprehensive assessment of someone's need. Now, during that time, they get all the teaching is from multiple conditions. So you're right, you might have a physiotherapist who hasn't done some particular training or isn't specifically trained in the mental health arena, but he would have an awful lot of training for, as a disability assessor, to understand how someone's mental health may affect their functional restriction. This is not a medical assessment that's looking at a diagnosis, an intervention or a prognosis. It's how a pathology affects their functional capacity. You're absolutely right, though. Having some insight about their background and how the condition usually affects people's capacity needs to be taught. And they undergo that teaching. They also, while they're doing their work, they're constantly supervised and supported. I want to get away from this, like, that we're scrutinising everyone. These are people who've, like, they've been in the caring profession for a long period of time. They want to do the best by the claimant. So we teach them to do that, and we constantly learn how to always do that better. That's why we have 100 people in a learning and development area of our business that actually distribute and teach new stuff all the time. Now, as well, it's very important to note, over 66% of the claims that come to us have multiple conditions. So they may have 6 and 7 conditions. And sometimes they write to us and think, this is the worst condition, therefore that's why I'm applying PIP for. And actually it's another condition that's affecting their functionality much more. But if you were to follow the logic that everyone had to have a specialism in a particular condition to assess someone with 7 conditions, you would be talking about 21 hours of assessment.
You see, well, I hear that, and I think it's really important that people know that the capital is doing then a lot to try to have these people as well informed as possible, and their baseline is that they're medical professionals before they get the extra training. That's what you're saying.
Great history takers and the right empathetic and insightful skills.
Okay.
Yeah.
If we come to the beginning of this interview, where you explained to me that, look, there's really 3 components to the assessment process. There's the claim form, there's then the assessment report that Capita does, and there are doctor's reports. Okay? I'm really confused with these doctor reports. So are people encouraged, and should people, when sending you information, should they be sending their current up-to-date doctor reports?
Absolutely. That's a yes. So Colm alluded to it earlier on. We and the 2 independent reviews, we need to educate people about what to send in. If you've anything that's about your care or someone caring for you, or any report, whether it's from a psychiatric nurse or your carer at home or your doctor, both reviews have said it's not always the doctor's report that's the best one that informs the functional assessment. It's other reports. But the absolute answer is yes, send in the information that you think is relevant to your condition. And actually, there's what's called a GP factual record. It's a form that they send or ask the GP to fill in. So, you know, we get them back sometimes. We don't get them back a lot of the time. Doctors are very busy. Sometimes they haven't seen the patient for a long time or claimant for a long time. I'd emphasise not only medical evidence, Stephen. Paul Gray talks about any evidence they think is relevant to the care that they require every day.
And how much weight is then given? How does this work? So if there is a doctor's report saying, look, this is a profound disability, and if your assessor then assesses that it's not, what happens?
So it's not that someone has a profound disability. We want a GP or any person, a carer, to write specifically about how their day-to-day, their pathology affects their day-to-day functioning, because then it matches up with the descriptors that Shah so aptly described. So it's much more about not just naming that they're having a hard time every day, and of course they are, they're challenged with these conditions. Someone with the same condition can score differently.
Can we talk about the bonuses which have been brought to our attention? Who deals with this? You
well,
or Sean?
I don't particularly deal with money and bonuses all the time, but I will address that.
So we know that for your assessors there is a £3,000 bonus, and we heard one of your colleagues at the briefing today said that part of qualifying for that bonus is on quality. It's absolutely what he said, and that's assessed. But he also said that it's based on volume of work. So there is an incentive built in by your profit-making organisation to say to your assessors, do this faster and you'll earn more. Is that safe?
The priority is quality. So they have to have the right quality standard. Like I've said to you, every assessment takes about 3 hours to do the whole lot of it. So you can't say someone's not going to sit and go have 12 or 20 assessments in a week because they think that it's going to be better for their incentive, because they won't be able to produce a good quality report.
And this is coming up time and time again from our listeners, so people know about this. Some of your assessors have contacted us, so that you know. Okay? In terms of the bonus, is quality scored higher in terms of qualifying for a bonus than volume of work?
Yes.
So how does it work?
So it works that you have to hit a number of metrics, of which quality is the first and foremost. If you don't hit quality, the rest of it doesn't matter. And we assess it through a mechanism called a training needs analysis, TNA, which I can say, I can look at Stephen's reports now and see how many words he writes.
Not sure how much bonus you'd give me after this.
How many words he writes and when they get them in. But first thing it looks at is, are they all A-grade reports? And if they're not, then immediately the disability assessor is going to need some support and potentially performance management, because I can tell that they're maybe struggling on certain descriptors and they're not getting
an A-grade
report.
How much emphasis is put on volume of work?
Well, there's emphasis on... First of all, when I was an orthopaedic surgeon, I had maybe 150 people in a clinic in an afternoon, and I would see them in maybe 90 minutes to 2 hours. I'd see them for maybe 2 to 3 minutes each. So, and I was expected to make sure I was getting it right every time.
Yeah.
But you can see that there's a pressure on volume because there's waiting lists.
That was in the NHS, though.
Yes, and people need to be seen.
But you didn't have a financial incentive to do more operations in the NHS.
But we do have to get through a large caseload.
This is more money. Do it quicker, get more money.
But not if you don't hit the quality. For quality's first and foremost. So, like, you don't get your quality, the rest of it is irrelevant.
And, Colm, to be fair, there is pressure on the system to give people the results.
There is, and we also apply pressure back onto Capita to make sure that the level of rework is kept to a minimum level.
How much are you scrutinising what they're doing? How much pressure are you putting under Capita to performance manage? And are they doing a good job?
We meet Capita every month. Officials meet Capita every month. I have an annual stock take with them based on all of those 12 sessions. There's a pressure test here.
So an opportunity to reach out to the public this morning. What do you say to them, Colm?
What I'm saying to them is, Pip is a young benefit that's evolving and maturing. I'm very pleased with the progress that it's making generally so far. There is scope for improvement. We're continuing to learn. Anybody has any issues in their cases, give us a call, come and see us. We'll deal with these issues, and if there's any problems, we'll put them right. So it's open. It's open. We are open to deal with these things.
Shah?
Well, I will say to the public that even if the condition is very severe and complex, it may not mean that they will be scoring the highest descriptor in each and every activity. However, if they feel that we have underscored them or we have scored them incorrectly, please get in touch with us.
I think the big message, Stephen, is that we care as a group, and that I don't want claimants to be any more stressed than they have to be when they're going to come and have this assessment. So please contact us if you're feeling worried.
And final thing from me, Colm, we've passed every case that we've aired on to your department, and we've also passed them on to Capita. Have you reached out to those people?
We're in the process of doing that. Some of the issues that are complex enough issues, so we're digging their way through those and we're reaching out. Now that's been done automatically. We're picking that up.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you
very much.
Now, if you do have any concerns about personal independent payments, you can contact the PIP Inquiry Line, 0800 587 0932. 0800 587 0932. And look, I know today's been a heavy show. I know that was long and detailed, but I think PIP is affecting so many people. And you've been expressing so much concern to us that I wanted to give both the department and the Capita, who do the assessments, an opportunity, first of all, to be held accountable on your behalf, and secondly, to explain to you where they're coming from. There is a PIP inquiry line. If you do have inquiries, the Department of Communities are encouraging you to use that, 0800 587 0932. 0800 587 0932.